Some historians dub the Weeks Act one of the most important pieces of environmental legislation in the 20th century. Char Miller is director of environmental analysis at Pomona College in Claremont, California.
It established for the first time, especially on environmental issues, that the federal government and the states had the capacity to forge a new relationship. And that new relationship was going to be based on the federal government buying private land, which it had never done before, and use that land to create national forests, which it had also never done before in the East.
The end result has been the creation of more than 26 million acres of national forests in the eastern United States. But to truly understand why the Weeks Act is so important, one has to understand what New Hampshire was like at the end of the 19th century. At St. Kieran Arts Center in Berlin, a photography exhibit commemorating the 100th anniversary of the act illustrates just that. Historian Marcia Schmidt-Blaine with Plymouth State University points to a picture of what was once Zeeland, New Hampshire, in the White Mountains near the headwaters of the Pemigewasset. Logging tycoon J.E. Henry owned a 10,000-acre tract here in the 1880s.
This was one of J.E. Henry's towns where he had lots of people come, created a town, people lived there, they had a school, they had stores, and then when he had taken all the wood that he could out of the area and moved on to Lincoln, the town died.
Historian Linda Upman Bornstein with PSU says unscrupulous sawmill loggers would decimate the forest. It's hard to believe these days, but even Crawford Notch was clear-cut.
The sawmill loggers, the J.E. Henrys, were only there to clear-cut, cut the logs, sawmill them, ship them on the trains to Portland or Boston. They did not care what happened to the forest after they were gone. They made their money and left.
And they often left slash behind, the remnant branches, which easily became kindling for fire. In the late 1800s, the fires came with a vengeance, burning thousands of acres. Schmidt-Blaine points to another picture in the exhibit.
So you've got a picture of an area that had been burned several times, and what you see are the remaining rocks, because the fire was so dramatic and so hot that it burned everything that was flammable.
The exhibit describes a blackened, gnarled landscape. And since the trees were gone, nothing held back the water from rains and snow. Flooding was commonplace. In 1896, the flooding was so bad along the Merrimack River that the largest cotton mill in the nation, Amiskeag Mills in Manchester, had to close, laying off 6,000 workers. Politicians and the public back then were reluctant to interfere with private property rights. But the Reverend John E. Johnson, an Episcopal missionary, came to North Woodstock and changed some minds. Historian Char Miller says Johnson saw poor New Hampshire families struggling to survive because of the timber industry.
In the end, they did what lumber companies did everywhere, which is to leave when the getting was good. And what they left behind were communities that had depended upon that labor, but were left adrift once they disappeared. Worse, those who stayed had very little ability to recover economically, and those were the people that Johnson was most deeply worried about.
In 1900, Johnson wrote a pamphlet calling the New Hampshire Land Company the boa constrictor of the White Mountains. The pamphlet was quickly picked up by the New England Homestead magazine and reached some 40,000 homes. PSU historian Marcia Schmidt-Blaine.
What he did was to create one villain, one group you can look at and name, that's the problem, that's what we need to end. And he woke up enough people that in 1900 he wrote it, and in 1901 the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests were created because of his work.
The first thing the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests did was to hire forester Philip Ayers. A well-educated historian, organizer, and publicist, Ayers became the main lobbyist to stop the deforestation and create a national forest. He took pictures and showed them to whoever would listen. Schmidt-Blaine says he talked to timber owners, logging operators, mill workers, tourists, and assembled a coalition of supporters.
He went to Grange meetings, he went to women's clubs, he went to anybody that would listen to him and to talk to him, and he found out what people wanted, and that was to have a working forest.
In 1903, a drought helped Ayers appeal for immediate federal action. He wrote in his journal, May 15th, Whitefield, town encircled by forest fires. June 3rd, Groveton, mills closed and all men gone to fight fire. June 5th, Grange, showers of fine ashes constantly falling. By the time it was over, 200,000 acres of what was left of New Hampshire's forests burned. That's when the congressional battle began, says Schmidt-Blaine.
In 1903, New Hampshire's congressman introduced the first bill to save the White Mountains. There was also a bill to save the Southern Appalachians, and at first those two were working at odds. They were not working at all well together.
But eventually, by joining forces with the Southern interests, a bill to allow the federal purchase of forests was born. But getting it through Congress was tough and took years. The House Speaker at the time, Joe Cannon, had famously said, "Not 1 cent for scenery." Enter John Wingate Weeks, for which the bill was named. He was a Massachusetts congressman who was born and had a family home in Lancaster, New Hampshire. Historian Char Miller says Weeks played a coalescing role.
He becomes the face of a bill that's obviously going to benefit his old neighborhood. I think it's also valuable that he was a banker. And Cannon could stand back and say, well, the economic interests say this is okay, and it's going to be framed around economic language. Weeks just cut away all of that aesthetic language.
Weeks' bill simply said that Congress would appropriate funds to purchase land for the conservation and improvement of the navigability of a river. The bill didn't mention the Appalachians or the White Mountains, and so proponents could say not 1 cent was going for scenery. It was going to promote commerce by protecting the flow of rivers. The bill passed, and President Taft signed it. In 1913, the federal government bought its first tract of land in what would become North Carolina's Pisgah National Forest. Later that year, federal officials began buying land in the White Mountains. The Weeks Act authorized federal purchases of land, which eventually became 48 national forests.
This is a picture of John Weeks around the time of the Weeks Act.
And as Schmidt-Blaine walks through the centennial exhibit, she says the East would look different today if it weren't for the Weeks Act.
It created a working forest, one that we can recreate in and that we can enjoy, but that people can still live here and be able to survive based on the forest.
And as Thad Gulbranson, director of the Center for Rural Partnerships, describes it, without New Hampshire, the Weeks Act may never have happened.
It's this landscape that inspired it, and it's the unique relationship between economy and environment that people here understand that made all that possible.
The photo exhibit, Protecting the Forest, the Weeks Act of 1911, will be at the St. Kieran Arts Center in Berlin until March 31st. After that, it will be at the National Forest Service in Campton. For NHPR News, I'm Amy Quinton.